Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Singer-songwriter Melanie Sofka, better known as simply Melanie, burst onto the folk scene at Woodstock in 1969.
I rode my bicycle past your window last night.
They done to my song, Ma. Look what they done to my song. Well, it's the only thing that I could do half right, and it's turning out all wrong, Ma. Look what they done to my song.
Melanie is performing with her son, Beau Jarrett, at the Bearsville Theater on Saturday, June 2nd at 9 p.m. Doors open at 8. Melanie has a new record, currently only available on her website and at live shows, entitled Ever Since You Never Heard of Me. Melanie joins us now to talk about some songs on the new album, the loss of her husband and manager Peter last year, and of course, Woodstock. Melanie, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How long have you been working on your new record?
Well, it was about 6 months, I suppose. But we finished it a year or so ago, but my husband, who is my producer and manager and best friends and partner and father of our three children, passed away suddenly. So we've just kind of been holding on to it, not exactly knowing what to do. We will, but right now it's just in my website and I bring it to concerts, but it's not out, you know.
Right. It must be so hard, in addition to losing your spouse and best friend, to, as you said, lose a producer and manager, and then on top of normal grief and mourning, have to figure out how to get a record out and how to...
Yeah, well, that's what we haven't quite figured out what to do. Mm-hmm. But Beau and I, my son is the guitar player, and he's... on his own, he plays concert guitar,
right.
And he's played all over the world. And we have been the artists, and Peter, he was always the guy who did all the figuring out and the logistics and the business and everything. We didn't even drive. he was the driver. So it's not, you know, something. I think it's almost a tender mercy that we have so much to do, because I think that's what's gotten us through. And certainly the performances, that's where I sense he's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it totally feels like he's there when I'm singing.
Why is the record called Ever Since You Never Heard of Me?
I suppose I have a very strange career. I have pockets of things, places where I'm very well known, and then there are other people who have no idea, you know, Melanie who,
mm-hmm.
and what, and, and maybe if I sing a few verses of Brand New Key or something, they might figure it out. But
right.
So it's just a recognition of, you know, hey, this is the way it is, and there are a lot of people who forgot all about me, and this is what I've been doing, and that's the picture on the cover is a vintage snapshot of us going over on to the Isle of Wight in 1970, and in the hovercraft. So it's just kind of tying up the Melanie who is and the Melanie who was.
Your first instrument, I read, was the ukulele. Do you ever pick it up and play it now?
Yeah, the baritone ukulele. I mean, I don't do it in shows.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those difficult instruments to mic, and I don't have a an electric ukulele. It's become the rage. I was actually pretty mortified as a teenager that I played something called a ukulele because it was so associated with Arthur Godfrey, who was a kind of, I don't know, just sort of as a farty instrument. And although I didn't play the little teeny tiny ukulele that Tiny Tim played, I played a baritone ukulele, which had a little more meat, but it was just not, you know, not a cool instrument to play at all. But I did. That was what I learned on the four strings of the ukulele. And when I was about 15, my dad got me a guitar, and that was so much nicer to say I played the guitar.
Performing at Woodstock is so closely associated with you, and any coverage about you or any, you know, press release announcing that you're coming to town. How often do you actually think of Woodstock? Like in your day-to-day life, is it something that you think about a lot or just something that people like me bring up to you and then you have to tell us about it?
No, I don't think about it until somebody brings it up, and then I might muse on it later or before if I know that that's what's going to be talked about. It's not something that I'm exhausted with, you know, because it was a completely magical event for me. And a lot of people over the years, I've noticed it being covered. It's changed. It's when it was first, like in the 80s, it would be covered with a cynicism, like, oh yeah, it's a Woodstock, like a bunch of burned out hippies, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the character from Taxi. You know, it was kind of made fun of and just discounted as anything that existed that would be changing the face of human existence. Of course, when it was happening, that's exactly what it felt like. It felt like a near renaissance on Earth. It felt like, you know, the world is going to change now, and all this insanity and inhumanity is going to go away. And, I mean, something as beautiful and real as that can never really go out of style, but there were attempts, I think, and now it's reared its head again. It does every so often, and people are, you know, born-again hippies and listening to 70s, 60s music and finding the source of where a lot of people now have this kind of imitative, you know, a lot of it. I think that the genuine realness in the music, and I know my husband was a producer, so he always went for the feel, you know. And when recording went into the business mode and people were looking to save money in studios and they would hire a drummer to play a loop and have that loop played on six different records, you know, then it became about the price per hour of studio time. What happened was the canvas got too expensive, and that motivated people to want to do things a little more economically, and the feel unfortunately suffered. But Bo and Peter had this amazing combination, because Peter was totally old school and Bo is both. He has, you know, the best of both worlds. He is completely a technician, and he's completely an artist. They worked together on this last album, and Bo said he's so grateful that he got to really produce an album with his dad, because he now can run that by every mix he makes and every instrument he puts on. He can hear his dad saying, "You don't need that."
I want to play part of a few songs from the new album. I chose three, and I wanted to ask you to talk about each of them a little bit.
Okay.
The first one is "I Tried to Die Young." Tell us about that song.
I think that the joke of the '60s is never trust anyone over 30, and leave a beautiful corpse. I fell into that a bit. You know, I guess artists can fall into that reckless abandon. You know, what's the point? You know, life is such an enigma. You know that when you're younger and you're creating life is this huge whirlwind. You can do self-destructive things, you mm-hmm. know. And now that you know, if you last and live past it, I thought of it is just amazing pathos, irony. You know that you live past that, and then you say, "Gee, I wish I didn't do that." And then maybe it would have been better if I hadn't done that. You know, you're not thinking that life ever really changes. I mean, you know it, but it's not a reality. You know, so you live in the moment, which is a great thing. But living in the moment in a destructive way is not such a great thing.
I tried to die young. Why did I try? But the voice deep inside would not let me succumb. And I laugh at the things that I've done when I tried to die young. I took a plane through the dawn, threw myself on the tracks, but the train didn't come. Had to walk back. I jumped into the whirlpool. Thought I'd get sucked in, but I just kept spinning around till I learned how to swim. And I tried to die young. What did I try? But the voice deep inside would not let me succumb.
Working Legend, what's that about?
I was thinking of having Johnny Cash record this song when I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he passed away, I knew I'd never get that chance. So lived for love, died for love, cried for love, died for love, and lived. It was just that he had that I tried to die young attitude, I think, to a great extent. And the idea that he wasn't there to record that song anymore inspired the way we produced it. And we put actual footage, not footage, but the audio from the footage of when I did his show. I had done his show 2 times.
Right.
So we have his intro to me and some of his comments on the recording. It was written in first person, you know, I lived for love, I cried for love, died for love, and lived. But when he passed away, I changed it to he.
He is just a working legend, and it takes up all his nights. He's given up on happy endings, but not without a fight. He propped himself up on jagged edges, fell into the dark abyss, and he lived for love, he cried for love, he died for love and lived. Yeah, he lived for love, he cried for love, he died for love and lived.
Hey, that's nice.
And the last song is Hushabye.
Oh, I love that song. You know, it has that subtlety. You know, it's not a preachy. It's more of a pro-peace song than an anti-war song. You know, it is that, but it has a subtlety in it that I love. If they're ever going to make a remake of On the Beach, I think that should be the song they sing at the end when They're the last people on earth somewhere down under.
After all is said and done, Daddy's a hero. You are a widow's son. And after all the fighting's done, life will take over. No one will have one soul. Hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye, baby, hush-a-bye. Don't you cry.
Melanie, thank you very much for joining us, and have a great time at Bearsville.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Melanie is performing with her son, Beau Jarrett, at Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York, on Saturday, June 2nd. For tickets and information, visit bearsvilletheater.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
After all the fighting's done, life will take over. No one will have won. And when this world's gone on too long, life will take over. There will be more to come, so hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye, baby, hush-a-bye.